For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Ancient Dragon Zengate. For new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here, and I'm very happy to have with us this morning to give the talk Joe Galuski. Joe is a priest ordained by Norman Fisher, who's been here before, a former abbot at San Francisco Zen Center. Joe co-leads our affiliate Sangha in Albuquerque, New Mexico, together with Kazan Titus O'Brien, who's been a priest here. Joe is also, along with being an experienced Zen priest, is a climate scientist, teaches at the University of New Mexico, and we'll be talking today about some aspects of Buddhist responses and perspectives on climate. So thank you very much, Joe, for being here.
Thank you. Thanks, Taigen. It's really great to be here, and nice to see all of you. How many of you are newcomers here this morning? Oh, good. Well, welcome. So it's really nice to be back in Chicago. I took a semester off of college almost 30 years ago. I think I was a sophomore, and worked at my brother's company down at the Chicago Board Options Exchange. And it turned out that was a really important time for me. That it was only like 6 months, but it was when I was living in Chicago, I was very interested in caving. I had gotten interested in that back in Texas where I grew up. And I spent a lot of weekends down at Mammoth Cave National Park, which I now recognize is not very close to Chicago. But I would drive down there and work with the Cave Research Foundation, a really wonderful organization. And it was there that I first met earth scientists, and that's when I first realized that there are people in the world who do the things that I want to do for a living, and they are called scientists, specifically earth scientists. And I went back to Texas A&M and got my degree in geophysics. And then I went to graduate school at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And it was when I was at Santa Cruz that I first encountered Zen practice. And I got into that because I was suffering. I was really excited to be in graduate school. I had some good friends. I had a nice girlfriend. But there was some way in which I was still feeling very ill at ease in my life, unsettled. And a counselor suggested that meditation might be helpful. And I quickly found some of the books by Ram Dass, who I still recommend to newcomers, some wonderful books. And I very quickly found the Santa Cruz Zen Center. Catherine Thanis was the teacher there then, a wonderful teacher who passed away a few years ago. And Zen practice grabbed me right away. I did not do much spiritual shopping. I found that the teachings of Dogen and the practice of Zazen were extremely appealing. And that, for me, there was a sense that even though I was able to kind of arrange the external circumstances of my life to be in accordance with my preferences, I still was not satisfied. And the teachings of the Buddha really helped address that for me, and that, the practice of Zazen, of being present with whatever is going on in each moment, kind of not trying to make it better, has been extremely helpful for me. So I did not come to practice with an idea that, like, oh, I want to find some Buddhist response to the environmental crisis. But as I continued practicing and studying, especially, the writings of Dogen Zenji, and you look at the Chinese landscape art, it's not hard to get this sense of some connection between Buddhist practice and what we might call the natural world, the environment. So it's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I've spent time at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, where I think some of you have visited out in California. It's a wonderful place, beautiful place, way off the grid, 14 miles up a dirt road up in the mountains. And I think when we come to a spiritual practice, even if we're not seeking some response to societal issues, after a while we do start to feel that our spiritual lives and the broader community life that we're part of are not separate. And so we do seek, I think, some connection between our spiritual practice and some of the things that we see going on in the world around us. And I've been studying sort of explicitly Buddhist responses to environmental crises for some time. And, I think we have to acknowledge, at least from a certain point of view, the Buddha did not teach, of course, about climate change, right? Nor did he teach about environmental crises. He really was very clear in his teachings that he focused on suffering and its cessation. And very famously, whenever someone would try to draw him into a broader conversation about bigger issues, he would kind of keep coming back. I teach these two things, suffering and cessation. And, we have some sense of the natural world as a place that we go for healing, for peace, for retreat. That's not always been the case. And if you look at the Buddha's original teachings about the environment, or teaching about the natural world, if you see references in the original sutras to the natural world, it's usually in the context of the natural world being a place of fear, a place where there's tigers that can eat us, terrible floods. It was not conceived of in India at the time of the Buddha in the same way that we conceive of it. I don't think people went camping. And even in the Chinese tradition, where there's this beautiful Chinese landscape art, beautiful poetry, and much of Dogen Zenji's writings about the natural world. I'll read a little bit of Dogen in a little bit. I think it's pretty clear that they did not relate to the natural world in the same way that we did. The sense of environmental stewardship that we might have, or conservation, these were not things that they were thinking about. I actually shifted gears in my career from studying kind of the deeper time aspects of the Earth to more current problems of climate change, future climate change problems. And I've come to think about this issue in kind of two ways. And often our practice, we think of it in terms of kind of wisdom and compassion. And there's different ways that you can divide that. And one way that I thought about this on the side of wisdom, we talk about the three marks of existence. This is one of the Buddha's original and very early teachings. There's different translations, but it's impermanence, no self, and suffering. And there's different ways that we can understand these, but impermanence, I don't think, needs a lot of explanation, right? We recognize that everything around us is changing all the time. Our hearts are changing. Our bodies are changing. The world around us is changing. And interdependence, I think, is something that most of us have a pretty good sense of, that everything is connected, right? We may have some idea of things being separate or disconnected from each other, but when we really look deeply, we see how what happens inside of ourselves affects what happens to others around us, how other people affect us, and of course how we affect the world around us. But when we try to take these things as permanent, when we look around, see our own lives, the lives of our loved ones, if we take those as permanent and as separately existing, we suffer, right? We are let down by the fact that all of us in this room are going to grow old and get sick and die. So this is kind of the reality that we've come to see. And I think when we sit in Zazen a lot, we really feel this in our own hearts, in our own bodies. So from a particular point of view, we can recognize, even when we look around the natural world and think about the problems of changing climate, that everything is changing, right? And we've seen from the last century that if we try to prevent forest fires, try to prevent wildfires, that creates its own kind of problems, that everything is a dynamic system. And the way I've taught about this, I teach a freshman environmental science class at the University of New Mexico, humans, biologically modern humans, have been around for a couple of 100,000 years, give or take. And these are people who physically were just like you and me. But it's only been in about the last 8,000 years that any kind of cities, anything we might call civilization, has developed. And obviously, industrial civilization has only been around for the last 150 years or so. And if you look at any measure of climate change, it turns out that around 6,000, 8,000 years ago, the climate, the Earth's climate, became remarkably stable. Maybe the most stable it's been in a few 100,000 years. Sea level steadied out, temperatures equalized, and it's pretty clear now that society as we know it seems to require some stability in the climate. And there's many of you, I'm sure, have read some of the work of Jared Diamond, a wonderful writer who's written a lot about this. I recommend his books on this topic. The life that humans were leading before the Earth's climate became stable was very different than a lifestyle that most of us would recognize, and probably very different than a lifestyle most of us would want to live. It was a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. You can't really build a city when you're running away from a saber-toothed tiger, I guess. when I come to my work as a geologist, I have a kind of a deep time perspective that the Earth is a dynamic system. It's always been changing. And our society, our civilization, to the extent that we wish to preserve some aspects of our life today, does seem to require some stability in the climate system. And it's a question for me about whether or not that's actually possible, even outside of the problem of man-made climate change. So I'll say more about that in a little bit. And then the other side of our practice often, so we have wisdom on the one side, there's emptiness teachings of interdependence and impermanence. The other side of our practice is the practice of compassion, right? We have this bodhisattva vow that we take to save all sentient beings. We have a set of precepts about how we relate to one another in a way that is upright and kind. And we really need both aspects. If we only have the emptiness side, if we only have the wisdom side, our teaching and our lives and our practice can become quite cold. But if we only have the compassion side without the wisdom side, our practice can become somewhat maybe ungrounded. So we really need both aspects of this. So as the years have gone on, I've gotten more involved in work more directly in climate change. And some years ago, I got to do some field work in Peru, in the Peruvian Andes, at a place called the Calcaya Ice Cap. And it's a famous site. It's the largest tropical glacier on Earth, and it's very rapidly melting. And I got to go there with a remarkable team of scientists, and it was a physically very, very challenging place to work because we were camping up at over 17,000 feet, working up at almost 19,000 feet. So the experience was very physical. It was not an intellectual experience being there. It was just about trying to survive that altitude, trying to walk. I found that you have to, even walking at that altitude, you pretty much have to walk like you're doing quinine. And as part of the acclimatization that we do there, it's like a 2-week-long trip, and all of it's about acclimatizing to the altitude. And I got to spend one day kind of by myself at the margins of this glacier. So this is one of the places where people are really concerned about the Earth's changing climate. The glacier is melting extraordinarily rapidly. It's unequivocally melting due to man-made climate change. And I wrote this writing on this while I was at the site. I want to share some of this with you. All right, so this is what I wrote soon after I got back from the trip. So this is about the Calcaya Ice Cap in Peru. So I said, I was lucky to be able to spend most of the day by myself at the margin of the glacier, where ice meets bedrock, about a half hour's hike from the base camp. This ice cap, even though it is rapidly melting, is immense, many, many miles across, and the site is essentially silent. So the overall experience of being in the presence of this glacier is one of immensity, stillness, and deep, deep silence. Sitting there, you can see that the glacier is not involved in our spinning, busy ideas about climate change and greenhouse gases and who's a Republican and who's a Democrat. The glacier is clearly melting, and it was remarkable to just sit there and watch the dripping from the side of the glacier, right? I experienced it in terms of the most basic Buddhist teaching of impermanence. All conditioned things arise, abide for a time, and pass away. As far as we can tell, this particular glacier has completely melted and regrown many times over the last hundreds of thousands of years. This impermanence is very impersonal. It doesn't matter what we think about it, or how we feel about it, or how we vote, or what we drive. The impermanence is simply the nature of things. In fact, when we say things, what we really mean is impermanence. It is awesome. I'll go on a second. Reading this now after a couple of years after that trip, one of the things that really comes up for me when we talk about our practice and a changing within a Buddhist response to a changing climate is what is it that we are trying to preserve? Because if we really do recognize impermanence and the dynamic nature of everything, what does that mean for our goals as people who are maybe concerned about man-made climate change? Are we trying to halt the melting of glaciers? Are we trying to preserve the natural world the way it was in 1820? I guess some important baseline that we want to preserve for as long as possible. I think actually one of the contributions that practitioners have to this conversation is the recognition of this, the dynamism of the natural world. And I don't have an answer for that in terms of what our goals should be, but I think a Buddhist response has to include this deep recognition of transience. So we can talk about that more. So then I go on from this trip to Peru. I say, usually we don't see this fundamentally flowing, impermanent nature of things, especially things like mountains and glaciers that seem like they should be more reliable. When we sit in Zazen, we can start to see how this flowing quality is the nature of our own minds. But can we see that this is really the nature of absolutely everything? This is exactly what Dogen Zenji discusses in his fascicle Sansui Kyo, the Mountains and Waters Sutra, which I'm sure you guys have talked about over the years here. Normally, we think of a sutra as being the words of the Buddha, a teaching about the Dharma, but in this case, in Dogen's teaching, the mountains and waters are the sutra. The mountains are expressing the Dharma directly. And in this text, Dogen talks at great and very beautiful length about how the mountains and waters specifically express impermanence. And as when I first encountered this fascicle, when I was in graduate school, it spoke very much to the work I was doing, because I was studying mountains, how mountains grow, how waters affect mountains. So to me, it all seemed to kind of make sense. I won't read the whole thing because it's very long, but one part of it that there's many parts of it that are quite beautiful, but Dogen says, it is because of the baseness of the common person's point of view that we doubt the phrase, the blue mountains walk. Because of the crudeness of our limited experience, we are surprised by the words flowing mountain. Without having fully penetrated even the term flowing water, we just remain sunk in our limited perception. Beautiful. So, of course, change is the nature of everything, including the Earth's environment. But does that mean that we should just fatalistically accept man-made climate change? Say, oh, we can't do anything about it, so just move on. If all things arise, abide for a time, and pass away, doesn't that apply to the human race as a whole? It does apply to the human race as a whole, and the human species will certainly become extinct at some point. This will happen. An immense number of species have populated our planet since the dawn of life on Earth, and the vast majority of them have gone extinct. And there's no reason to expect that the human race is any different. So why make any effort on this issue if it's hopeless? That's apparently it. I just said it. So recall our Bodhisattva vow. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. set aside for the moment of whether or not mountains and glaciers are sentient beings. Don't be too concerned for the Earth, actually, which is of the nature of continuous ongoing change, or for the glacier, which has come and gone many times in the past and will likely do so in the future. But we definitely must be concerned about our fellow humans. As people, we are capable of a great deal of suffering, and there's no question that environmental change, climate change, is likely to create a lot of suffering for a lot of people. And I think that's where we should place our emphasis in terms of where practice intersects the problem of climate change. Yes, the glaciers will melt and there will be suffering. What can we do to help ease the suffering of our fellow humans? It certainly may mean engaging the society with the aim of ameliorating suffering. It may mean working to pass legislation to cap greenhouse gases so that the glaciers stop melting, at least for now, so that people have enough water. It may mean working with local communities to ensure stable water and food supplies. But it definitely means that as practitioners, it means we must be present with the difficulties that arise in each moment, whatever they are, with kindness and compassion, and responding with a full, open heart to whatever is going on. It definitely means not using climate change as a stick with which to beat others. Don't use climate change as a wedge against others or to create difficulty for others. There's enough suffering in the world without our own self-righteousness. As the great author Kurt Vonnegut once wrote, "Hello, babies. Welcome to Earth. It's hot in the summer and cold in the winter. It's round and wet and crowded. At the outside, babies, you've got about 100 years here. There's only one rule that I know of. God damn it, you've got to be kind." So these are some of my thoughts after this work in Peru. And I've continued to work on many of these problems, and actually it was just, it was nice reading about this question of working with local communities, because I've just recently gotten involved in a project in Nepal where we are, in fact, working with local communities to see how they perceive climate change, how they may be working to address it in their own local communities. And late last year, a group of us went to Nepal. This is before the earthquake, and spent about 3 weeks there working. If any of you have been to Nepal, we're along the Gandaki River from the edge of the Tibetan Plateau down to a place called Chitwan National Park. And I had never been to Nepal before, or South Asia, and we got to spend some time at Lumbini, which is the Buddha's birthplace. It was very powerful to visit there. And the remarkable thing about this trip is that we were meeting with lots of different partners on the ground, Nepalese working for the World Wildlife Fund, people working in government and other NGOs. And one of the things that really struck me during that was how especially the Buddhists that we met, how they were responding to climate change and how they were addressing some of these issues. And I want to read a little bit about some of those visits. So on the first day that we were in Nepal, and I should also say I was very sick on this trip. I had bronchitis before we even landed, and terrible air pollution, and then some gut things going on. So the background for me of all this was a lot of physical discomfort. On our first day, we met with the World Wildlife Fund, and I did not appreciate this before going on this trip, that these non-governmental organizations in places like Nepal do a lot of work on the ground that normally we think of governments as doing, but the Nepali government has challenges addressing a lot of what's going on. One of the heads of the local World Wildlife Fund in Nepal is from the Upper Mustang region and is a devoted Tibetan Buddhist. And there are terrible problems with the deforestation in the plains of southern Nepal, especially around Lumbini, where the Buddha was born. And this is very inspiring. The World Wildlife Fund has committed itself to planting 108,000 trees every year for the next 10 years in and around Lumbini. And they plan to plant native trees that would have been around at the time of the Buddha, including Ashoka, Sal, Pipal, and Kadam trees. These are trees that were mentioned in the original Buddhist suttas. It's an important, it will make the region into an important carbon sink, and it has the potential to really improve wildlife habitats, improve water quality, and the way the partners at the World Wildlife Fund talked about it, is it builds connections across the landscape while promoting harmony between humans, wildlife, and nature. That sounds pretty good to me. I like that. And he spoke with real passion and emotion about how this project is an expression of his Buddhist practice. And he's been actually conducting this work in kind of in conjunction and with guidance from his Tibetan teachers. At another meeting we went to at the Nepal Academy of Science and Technology, we went into the office of the Vice Chancellor, and there was this beautiful statue of a sitting Buddha. And as somebody who'd been around Zen centers for a long time, at first I didn't really, it's like, oh yeah, of course, there's a sitting Buddha. We've been around seeing those all the time. But wait a second, this is the office of a scientific administrator. And he actually began the meeting, and again, it was very confusing to me. He began the meeting by recounting the story of Buddha's awakening. And I had to like, wait a second, do you know that I'm a Buddhist? Where's this coming from? But I think this is kind of often how he begins these kind of meetings. And it was wonderful to think, like, how wonderful it would be if many of our work meetings began if we recounted the story of the Buddha or recited some sutras. So it was remarkable to me. I think I had maybe a little bit of a naive and probably not a very helpful point of view, thinking like, oh, I'm this Buddhist practitioner, I'm going to go to Nepal. I think I decided no one else had thought of this connection. But of course, you know, this chancellor from the Nepal Academy of Science spoke very directly about the links between how we address climate change and the teachings of the Buddha. And then go on here. Let's see. Yes, so... So we had several other meetings along these lines, and you know, I'm not a specialist in development. I'm primarily a scientist, but I did notice that I think climate change, the term climate change, has become a catch-all for a wide range of very legitimate grievances that people in small, poor countries have with their large neighbors. In Nepal, the response to climate change has to be primarily focused on adaptation, meaning how are we going to deal with this problem, rather than mitigation, because Nepal is not a large greenhouse gas emitter. They're tiny, but they are very, very affected by it, so they have to respond some way. So my sense from the Buddhists we encountered on the trip was that they felt that local actions are consistent with the Buddhist teaching and that they can be helpful in staving off the worst effects of climate change. And very notably, the Buddhists that we met with were not despairing about climate change or even complaining about it very much. Instead, they were all focused on the local concrete actions that they could actually take right now that could help the situation. It was a very pragmatic approach, very down to earth, and I found it very inspiring. The Buddha famously refused to address questions about the scope of his teachings and exhorted his students to focus on suffering and its cessation. His teachings on the origin of suffering imply a local response. In other words, the Buddha's teachings about suffering, that the causes of suffering are very near to us. It's not about going out and making some guy on the other side of the world do something that we want them to do, right? It's about our own response to the world, how we encounter the world. So rather than concerning ourselves with some ultimate cosmic cause of suffering, like, oh, it's God's will or something, you know, something like that, the Buddhist teaching emphasizes steps that we can actually take ourselves. So there may be some ultimate cosmic way of the universe that is the reason for all suffering, but what are you going to do about that, right? So the Buddhist teaching emphasizes a local response, a personal response. And I think that some of the spirit infused our Nepali colleagues and how they're approaching these issues. And even though poor countries like Nepal are very vulnerable to man-made climate change, they can't do much to stop it. But so one approach might be despair. That's a time-honored response to difficult situations. Or alternatively, we can roll up our sleeves and get to work on finding steps that we can take locally, however small, to do our part. And I teach at this freshman environmental science class at the University of New Mexico, and we talk a lot about climate change, and it's easy to feel like the class is kind of a bummer. And so I always want to leave students with some sense of optimism, which actually is how I feel. I'll say more about that in a second. But there's a wonderful story that Pete Seeger, the great folk singer Pete Seeger, used to tell about the power of individual small actions, and I really believe it. So He says, I honestly believe that the future is going to be millions of little things saving us. I imagine a big seesaw, and one end of this seesaw is on the ground with a basket half full of big rocks in it. The other end is up in the air. It's got a basket a quarter full of sand. And some of us got teaspoons, and we're trying to fill up the sand. And there's people out there saying, oh, you're crazy. You're never going to fill that bucket up with sand. The sand's leaking out as fast as you're putting it in. But one of these years, you'll see that whole seesaw go zoop in the other direction, and people will say, gee, how did that happen so suddenly? Just us and all our little teaspoons. So the problem of climate change is real, and it's probably even worse than we know, actually. And I know many people feel despair about this, feel really sad and frightened about it. And I, for myself, I don't, actually. I'm concerned about it. I don't feel despair about it. And it's not, that doesn't come from some intellectual place. I just, when I scan my heart, that's not what I feel. And part of that is just, there's abundant goodness in the world. And there will continue to be abundant goodness in the world. And, you know, even, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I think none of us do. I think this problem may change much more quickly than any of us can imagine. Those of us who are old enough to remember the end of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of apartheid, those were situations that seemed very stuck, and some things changed very quickly. Of course, many problems, more problems came out of those. There's no end to our problems. And, you know, while I don't necessarily want our descendants to live as hunter-gatherers, I'm also confident that, you know, 100,000 years ago, there was a lot of laughter and people enjoyed the company of their friends and loved ones, and parents loved their children. So I'm not frightened. I'm concerned, and we need to make our efforts where we can and when we can. Vigorous effort, in fact. But I think we can do that with a good spirit, and I think our practice can help us to remain grounded as we do that work. So I think I will end it there for now, and maybe we can have some time for some conversation.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. Wonderful. Yes, I agree. There is much that we can do and that can change. So we're going to extend our discussion time. We'll skip the temple cleaning this week. So does anyone have comments or questions or responses for Joe? Please feel free.
Well, one of the things that I tend to, I mean, I agree on that whatever happens, you know, while we're still here, and of course we will not always be here, but that parents will, you know, love their children and laugh together. And I mean, we've seen historically people have been able to do that and just awful situations, yeah. and that's really encouraging and wonderful. But I also think about the, you know, in terms of motivation for taking whatever actions we can, either as individuals or collectively. Mm-hmm. You know, the precept of not taking what is not given, mm-hmm. and trying to keep in mind that in some important way, of course, because we're human beings, that is our most immediate responsibility and focus, mm-hmm. but as you say, there are many other beings, mm-hmm. and in the world, and they will all also disappear, but it feels to me like there's a real moral imperative to not put ourselves in the position of making forests disappear and making, yes. other species disappear, and, you know, and keeping, you know, I really agree in, you know, with your focus on keeping things local, mm-hmm. and what our immediate response can be. But I also feel that it's really important to keep this bigger perspective and in a way focus on ourselves without, but at the same time maintain the awareness that it's really not all about ourselves. You know,
right. Kind of thing. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I agree completely. And there's been some interesting critiques coming out. I've really just been seeing these in the last few months. Naomi Klein has an important new book out called This Changes Everything, a critique of global capitalism and specifically around the climate change issue. And I've seen some other conversations around this. Geologists have started talking about the current geological era as the Anthropocene. Some of you may have heard this. That's the era in which humans have become a geological force. And the critique I've been hearing lately is interesting to me, and it gets to what you're talking about, which is that when we talk about the Anthropocene, it suggests that what the changes we're seeing are inherent to human nature. Mm-hmm. That this is just how people are, that people are fundamentally going to take things from the earth and burn them and wreck the climate. Naomi Klein talks about this, and there have been some other essays on this point, that it's not about that global capitalism may not be the same thing as human nature.
Yeah.
I think that's a point of view that might be accepted in this room. Yeah, that, you know, absolutely, we're capable of a lot of greed. That's obviously part of human nature. But we're also capable of a lot of other things. And I'm looking forward to seeing how some of those other possibilities may be expressed on the global stage.
Since you mentioned that, I was going to save this for announcement time, but it actually fits. Naomi Klein, her book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate, she has actually a very positive, hopeful perspective, which you indicated and I share, that this, you know, when difficult things happen to us individually, there are opportunities to change and to transform, and something new can happen. And from her perspective, this is what's happening to our species, and our response to climate and related issues allows us the possibility of really deep change in a really positive way. And I agree with you that changes can be very sudden after lots and lots
yes.
of work. But I wanted to mention for people here that there's a new film called This Changes Everything that she was involved with. There are a few flyers out front about it, but it's showing at the Music Box Theater that some of you know in Southport, October 20th at 7:30 p.m. There's a link there where you can get tickets in advance, but she's going to be there doing question and answer. So I would encourage people to make it Tuesday week, October 20th, 7:30 p.m. at the Music Box. And she worked on the film together with the director, talking about the possibilities of local positive responses. And while I'm mentioning that, another announcement, 350.org, which has done a lot to let people know about the realities of climate and to try and get people and try to help people to respond, is having an event, a climate justice vigil in March, this Wednesday, October 14th at 5 p.m., starting at Old St. Pat's Church, 700 West Adams, downtown. So there are a few flyers about that out front, but just following up on Naomi Klein, there are, and on what Yozan said about acting, and you said about acting locally, there's lots and lots and lots of people really working at this on many levels, and so, yeah, it's not, certainly not hopeless.
Yeah.
But other comments or responses? Yes, Brian.
I'm fairly practically minded, and I really respond to what you're saying about local action, and I like to hear about the kinds of things, Tiger, that you just mentioned, and there's lots of opportunities for engagement as individuals at a local level, Chicago or Albuquerque or wherever we are. What I'm wondering about is whether that sometimes local action can have more effectiveness or impetus for the people who are involved, perhaps, if it's a small group even. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the sangha in Albuquerque and whether this sangha here is either contemplating or involved in something specific at the local level.
That's a great question. Unfortunately, we're not. We probably should and could. And I agree with you that there's individual actions, and then if we think about it, it's kind of ripples expanding outward. If we connect with others locally, that kind of expands the impact. There's organizations that people know about, like the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, 350.org, is doing some very creative work on a lot of these issues. I think it's appropriate for sanghas to find ways to join together to the extent that people want to do that. And actually, we can have some more conversation about what that might look like in a Sangha, what a Sangha response might be. I think there's a lot of room for creativity on this. Yeah, when I first actually started hearing some of the words coming out of 350.org, I was a little bit skeptical. And I am a little bit skeptical about pinning a specific number. That 350 refers to the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. And if you stay above that, the idea is that you're doomed. And I don't like that because we're going to stay above that. We're not going below that in our lifetime, I don't think. And I don't think we're doomed. I don't think it's very good to draw those kind of really sharp lines. But they've done, Bill McKibben, who's one of the leaders, maybe the leader of 350.org, has done some remarkable work. So yeah, I think there's a lot of scope there, and it'd be interesting to chat about what that might look like.
And just to respond in terms of our Sangha, I would love it if people have ideas of things that we can do locally. Lots and lots of people in our Sangha are doing things individually, urban gardens. One thing that we're doing this month, and thank you, Katie, we're doing a group working at the Lakeview Pantry, just helping out, and we're going to, that group this month is kind of full, but there's a good response, and we're going to be doing more of those. But I invite and welcome any of you here to suggest kind of small group Sangha activities that we can do. I think that would be great. So other comments or questions, please.
Thank you so much for presenting what you noticed. And one of the issues that comes with me is if I become aware of a dramatic environmental change, unfortunately I personalize that and take it as issues against me. And so one of the practices that I hope I can find from that is learning how to accept it as it is, seeing if it's possible for me to be able to affect that in some small grain of sand way, you know. But that limits me then on, you know, what action I have. And so the Sangha here is already, I mean, I won't say it has because I'm not really familiar with it. I'm not from this area. But just hearing about the Naomi Klein film or the food kitchen, food bank, you know, are things that can help other people suffer, you know, assist in suffering from that. You know, so the suffering I look at is a little bit different than, you know, that. And so it probably is not really anything that we're talking much about, but you know, it's a matter of how do I go about, you know, finding that balance between compassion and non-self.
Right, yeah. No, thank you. I think there's a... one of the characteristics of our practice is that we develop this capacity to be present with difficult situations without meddling with them, without trying to make them better than what they are. And that's powerful for us to kind of, because we're used to like seeing a problem and immediately maybe we want to dive in and change it. And maybe this is something that's maybe political, or maybe it's something just more in our personal lives. If there's a problem, we're going to, you know, have an argument with somebody or try to change a situation. And practice really supports us to just be present with that. And for most people, that's a really powerful transition, just the ability to be present with something that's difficult. But I think sometimes we can actually go a little too far in that direction, and it can lead to kind of quietism, where we are maybe being present with a situation that actually needs to be changed. And that can range from something as small as, you know, during a session, you may have a lot of knee pain, and it may be that it's best to shift your posture. Like the teaching is, sit still, and that's a good teaching, but also that it has to include that when it's time to move, you should move. And that can expand outward to, you know, other things in our personal lives, or also things in the world around us. So I think there's benefits to being present with difficulty, but then we also have to know when we act, how to act.
Other comments or responses, please feel free. Yes, no, please. Go ahead.
Honestly, I'll prefer somebody because I always talk too much. But you know, just thinking in terms of responses you spoke about, for example, this guy or this person, I don't know, so, you know, female, the head of the Academy of Sciences, mm-hmm. in Paul. And I mean, it's just really striking that, you know, that guy and some of these other people you talk about apparently are not making this rigid separation. Mm-hmm. between what their spiritual life and practice is and what they are doing professionally, right. You know, and whether, you know, whether it's difficult to sort of orchestrate a sangha or any other group of people to do something together. But in fact, we are all involved in mm-hmm. multiple networks of people. And, I mean, I think it's very much encouraged anyway, but just I would just like to speak out, you know, if it's even necessary, about just not keeping our own spiritual life, we call it that, or our own sort of Buddhist aspiration sort of boxed up in the Zendo, yeah. you know, but actually, you know, letting them find, maybe actively finding ways to let that those things express themselves yeah. in our everyday situations, work situations, and so on and so forth, which may not mean having a Buddha image or, you know, sort of identifying yourself as Buddhist or even talking about it, but, you know, our capacities to positively influence situations in however grand or however incremental ways are with us always.
Yeah.
And I know for myself that in certain situations and some past work situations in particular, I tend to think, well, you know, this is just the way it is and I don't have that power, but you always do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that calls for kind of this mindfulness, just to remember, yeah. just remembering, you know, and then express it.
Yeah. No, thanks. I appreciate that. That's an important point. I think for a lot of us, we keep our work lives and maybe our spiritual lives a little bit separate. And I think probably on balance, it's good to be discreet.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, one has to find the appropriate avenues for expressing that. But I also do agree with you. And I think actually it could well be, I've just thought about this as you're describing that in the Nepali professional culture, there may not be that same distinction. I think there's something about the American psyche and just the nature of our society that we do tend to keep those things separate. And, you know, often I work in an earth science department, so I work with alumni who are old Texas oil and gas guys who are extremely conservative, but we have to find a way, place to meet and talk about matters of common interest. So there's some subtlety in that and how we handle that, but I think you're right that there's some value if we can find ways to express that in ways that are appropriate. Yeah, Tom.
One thing that I've seen talk about in terms of our perception of climate change, or that each generation has a different baseline
yeah.
of experiences.
Yeah.
And I played in the Northwoods in the 50s when I was a little kid, and the lakes were just alive with critters, leeches and crayfish and minnows and all kinds of critters.
Mm.
And going up there now, the lake's very quiet.
Yeah.
There's not much life in them. I mean, certainly there are fish out there, and but it's that inshore life at the margin is much less. And it's easy to feel a lot of grief about this.
Sure.
For what's gone. And I guess in this context, I just think that it's so useful to sit with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the other part of... I'm no kind of Buddhist student whatsoever, but I guess the endeavor to maintain kindness is the appropriate response in sitting with the loss.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I certainly don't mean to say that, you know, that we just... feeling the grief is an appropriate response, for sure. And there are also lots of people doing good work in our world about trying to restore these ecosystems, and it's a rich scientific problem, it's a rich ethical question about what that actually should look like, But diversity of life is a good thing. And when that starts to fade away, there's a genuine loss there. Kathy?
I was just thinking about, it's like, we don't do something particularly as a Sangha, but I do know a lot of people are involved in different things. But it makes me think about, like I was thinking about Friends of the Park and the Sierra Club, mm-hmm. which are things I'm more familiar with, that I respect the way they go about efforts locally. So it raises the issue of us joining with other organizations as well.
Yeah.
You know, with the food pantry, which I think is an important thing.
Yeah.
Just going back to something you said, Joe, about just sitting and not having some reactive need to respond, I think there's a kind of resilience that we develop by being willing to just be present with what is without pushing it around. And at the same time, that settling and steadiness, as I often talk about, is a kind of place from which we can respond more wholesomely without demonizing certain, people or whatever, just to look at the situation and how we respond together. And as Kathy was saying, I know many people in our Sangha are doing lots of really good things in their lives, and to get to herd cats together, to organize things for us to do together is challenging. But again, I want to invite any of you who have suggestions for Sangha projects with the Sierra Club or whatever to we can do that more. But when we are willing to just sit and be present and face the sadness and grief of all kinds of difficulties, personal and in the environment around us, we have a kind of power to be responsive, and to be responsive in a careful, kind way.
In addition to the grief and the hard work that needs to be done and the concern and all that, I was sitting here reminded of something I was watching last night, which was a badly done documentary on a singer that I've never liked very much, which is John Denver. But he said that what impressed me about John Denver, the way they portrayed him, was that he was incredibly joyful about nature, and especially the Rocky Mountains, and his songs reflected that, of course. And I thought, another side of this is the suchness of a walk in the park or going out to the lake, or I love to go to the Chicago Botanic Gardens. There's something about being filled with the suchness of beauty, natural beauty, that contributes somehow to our relationship. That can be a healing relationship with the earth. I'm not sure how that is other than being motivated, but mm-hmm. it certainly is part of it.
Yeah.
Get outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you might think you have to go someplace far away, but Chicago is blessed with some amazing parks. So I'm here in town with my wife and our 2-year-old daughter, and we're right by Lincoln Park, and so we've been going to the zoo every day. And, zoos are kind of sad places in many ways. But seeing it through the eyes of my daughter, she's just filled with awe seeing, the monkeys in the zoo and the conservatory that's up there, and just to see that joy that she experiences by making those connections. I feel that as well.